Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Our usual two segments light up tonight. First, in about 5 or 7 minutes, we'll speak with Josh Bivens, who is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, about the general state of the U.S. economy. Is the recession over? What, if anything, will the recovery look like? What was the last expansion like? And what, if anything, is the stimulus program doing to help us out? And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Steve Early, the veteran labor journalist, who is out with a new book from Monthly Review Press called Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. Steve Early not only writes about unions, but spent many years working for one, so he can give us a good perspective on what's going on in organized labor. And maybe I'll see if we can get some good news out of him, because I can't think of any off the top of my head, but maybe that's just my own pessimistic temperament kicking in. Okay, before all that, some words on the economic news. I've been saying here for several weeks, evidence accumulates that the U.S. housing market is finding a bottom, which is important because housing does, over the years, tend to lead ups and downs in the broad U.S. economy. Some mainstream news sources got a little carried away, pronouncing the housing contraction to be over. My guess is that this process of bottom finding will be spread out over several months and won't turn around seriously for even more time. But things are beginning to fall in place, maybe, probably. Last Thursday, on the 23rd, we learned from the National Association of Realtors that existing house sales rose by 3% in June, the third consecutive monthly increase, the best performance since 2004. And the yearly change in single-family house sales went positive, though just barely, for the first time since late 2005. That's not much, but it is the stuff of which market bottoms can be made. But prices, house prices, which are not seasonally adjusted, making month-to-month comparisons impossible, were off 15% from a year earlier, only a hair better than May's number, and still not all that far above the all-time low set in April. So it looks like product may be starting to move, but only with deep discounting. And on Monday, the Census Bureau reported that sales of new houses rose an impressive 11% in June. The yearly change is less impressive, though, off 21% from June 2008, but that's an 11-point improvement from May. Prices, however, are off 12% from a year earlier, worse than May, and one of the weaker readings in this down cycle. So here, too, product only moves with steep discounts. And then on Tuesday, we got the Case-Shiller-Weiss house price indexes for May. These are the best measure we have of the housing market. And national average prices were off just 0.2 points in May, but off 17% from a year earlier. Still, that's better than April's yearly figure, down 18%, and the previous 4 months, which were down around 19%. So, again, some things are looking up, some things are just falling at a less rapid rate, but this is what we call stabilization. As is traditional, as my colleagues in my youthful indiscretion of the party of the right used to say, let me add that the necessary caveats to these tales of recovery were at least bottom finding. There are credible reports circulating that banks are holding a large number of foreclosed houses off the market so as not to strangle any infant recovery in its crib. Presumably they're hoping to sell these quietly into a strengthening market, but that will be a weight on recovery in the months to come. Also, there's a lot of geographic variation behind the national averages. California looks to be stabilizing, but New York isn't. Former boom areas like Las Vegas and Phoenix are still busted. And some of the pickup in sales in improving areas may be from investors buying rather than would-be residents. The standard explanation for the spike in foreclosures and other signs of housing distress over the last couple of years is that people bought at the top of the market, and they now owe more on the mortgage than the house is worth. Maybe not. An interesting paper by three economists, Michael LaCour-Little of Cal State Fullerton and Eric Rosenblatt and Vincent Yao of Fannie Mae, looked at some recent foreclosures in Southern California. They found that virtually all of the borrowers who got into trouble did so not because their timing was bad, but because they'd borrowed so much against their houses. That is, through home equity loans and other forms of what's known in the trade as mortgage equity withdrawal, they tried to cash in on the appreciated value of their property. On average, the properties that the economists study were bought in 2002 and 2003, and they had actually appreciated in value by the time they entered foreclosure. The problem was the owners borrowed an amount nearly equal to or even exceeding that of the appreciation, finding themselves burdened by an unmanageable amount of debt in a declining market. Well, many of those foreclosed upon are suffering now. They didn't have to do all that borrowing. Yes, there are many people who were tricked into borrowing more than they could handle or even understood, and many who had really had little choice but to stretch to buy in a booming market. But there are also a bunch of grown-ups who made some dumb choices. This points to the complexity of the problem. Any attempt to bail out troubled borrowers would, to be fair, have to distinguish among different kinds. As I've noted here many times, the weak expansion that ran from 2001 through 2007 would have been much weaker had not people withdrawn several billion dollars in equity from their houses, several trillion dollars, sorry, in equity from their houses, using their houses as ATMs, a phrase I think I coined, which entered wide circulation. I've never seen a penny of royalties in all these unauthorized uses. We are now suffering a serious hangover from all that cash withdrawal binge, and it does make you wonder what would take its place to drive any future recovery. And the job market continues to show signs of improvement, at least by the indicators I report here every week, the jobless claims figures. First-time claims for unemployment insurance filed by people who've just lost their jobs rose by 25,000 last week, the second consecutive weekly increase. But as I said last week, these increases look to be undoing an unusually strong decline 3 weeks ago that was almost certainly the result of technical difficulties in seasonally adjusting the raw numbers. The four-week moving average, which smooths out all this noisiness, continues to drift lower and is now 15% below its April peak. And the count of people continuing to draw benefits, so-called continuing claims, which had been very sticky and failing to follow the initial claims lower during the spring, that's also now drifting lower. The two series are behaving very much like they do at the end of recessions. I'm still expecting only a weak recovery, especially for the job market, but it is looking more and more like the economy is starting to stabilize. That perception is driving commodity speculators nuts, though. On Thursday, crude oil prices posted their biggest one-day gain in 3 months. During the Bush years, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which regulates these markets, did a study showing that the spike in oil prices in 2007-2008 had nothing to do with speculation. And strangely, Paul Krugman agreed. Now it's looking like the new CFTC, under the new administration, is doing a rethink. The last thing the climate needs is a lot of cheap oil, but if we're going to raise energy prices, it should be through a carbon tax whose proceeds could be devoted to funding alternative energy research, and not through the kinds of price increases that only enrich oil companies and sheikhs. Ah, the best laid plans. An unplanned departure from the original version of this show. My first guest, Josh Bivens, didn't answer his phone at the appointed time, so I had to scramble. Rather than subject you to my meandering improvisation and some inferior music we used as filler while we tried to raise him, I'll play instead a lovely musical interlude, the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Trio No. 7, The Archduke, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Pincus Zukerman, and Jacqueline Dupre. And then part of a listener phone call, and ultimately on to Bivens, who finally did answer his phone. Thank you. That was the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Trio No. 7, The Archduke, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Pinchas Zukerman, and Jacqueline Dupre. Now let's return to the original broadcast, first with a listener call, and then on to Josh Bivens of EPI. Okay, welcome to Behind the News.
Doug Henwood, Daryl McPherson, Bronx, New York. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's up?
It is amazing. I've been listening to a lot of Bloomberg lately, especially after this thing, and taking what your comments were about the economy, it's interesting that the day-to-day blather hasn't changed since the crisis has sort of tamped down. And how would one go about getting real, other than your show every week, getting real accurate information? I find that the interviews that they do with some of the people are interesting, but the reporters are lost.
Bloomberg TV or the mayor?
I'm listening to it on AM radio, I guess it's the TV, because that's another piece that one time I would be interested in you doing an analysis of how he's got this worldwide network hooked up that's making tons of money. Is there a rival for that?
Well, there are some rivals, Reuters, Telerate, but the people on Wall Street love those Bloomberg terminals more than anything. They have an awful lot of information in them, and they present it in a way that they really like. So he delivered a product that everyone loves, and it costs, I think, about $1,300 a month just to rent one terminal. So it's a very, very lucrative business for a bunch of people.
That's what they mean. Thank you.
So, they can punch up, quotes in the markets, but they also get histories and an analysis and all kinds of things on those machines.
Well, how do we go about getting,
if you got
not that, but I'm talking about the same kind of information. I mean, we were told since, 75, 85, that we need to be responsible. This is an owner society, blah, 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 blah. However, when you go out to get the information, if you don't already have the capital, you're doomed. And even if you do have the capital, you may be doomed.
Yeah, well, these markets are not for people who are not professionals. Things are so stacked in favor of the pros that I would be very wary of recommending anybody get involved in these kinds of games. If you want to just find out what's going on for the sake of knowing what's going on, I think the business press is often quite good. I think the Wall Street Journal is a very good newspaper, even under Rupert Murdoch's control. The Financial Times is an excellent newspaper. I still read these things on newsprint. I'm an old-fashioned guy. But they also have websites which report a lot of information. But I think those, if you really want to know what's going on in the economic world and the political world, I mean, they do a lot of good political reporting, and they're very good at reporting the relationship between money and power in ways that general papers, like the Times in particular, don't necessarily do as well. I mean, the New York Times is better. I hate to kick it now that it seems to be dying, because it is still a very useful source of information. But if you want to know what's going on in the worlds of money and power, I think the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times are tremendously excellent sources of day-to-day information.
Well, how do we then translate that from a labor point of view so that people get some decent information and understand what their place is in the overall scheme of things? Because what I encounter is people, not only do they not understand the basics of a market, but, for instance, in the healthcare debate, right? If you started from the end and said, what's the goal? The goal is to have healthy people. Well, how do you go about that? You would, I don't know anybody who likes their healthcare the way it's set up. And I heard somebody else say previously that the only people who like the current health care haven't used it because so many people are going bankrupt.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the case. I think, we've got this big political problem now a lot of people are dissatisfied with the healthcare setup. But on the other hand, what Obama and the Democrats have proposed is not anything that's transformative or anything that people can get enthusiastic about. It's complicated, compromised, weak, and it's just impossible to generate any kind of support for it. So we've got this really mixed up situation in which things are bad, but nobody's really proposing anything that's significantly better. So at best, we're going to get some harebrained, half-baked transformation that's not going to make anything much better and scares people into thinking that things are going to get worse. So this political situation is around healthcare is dire, I'm sorry to say.
Is that because the information available to the average individual is still focused on insurance and not on health care?
All right, thank you for your call.
You got it.
We've got to move on now. Right, I think we've got Josh Bibbins on the line. Do we have Josh Bibbins on the line?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Well, thank you. We're a little worried that you weren't going to materialize on the other end of the phone there.
Yeah, I was having phone nightmares. Hopefully this will hold up.
Okay, well, let's see if it does. All right, well, the topic I wanted to – I should introduce you more properly. Josh Bibbins is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington. And I wanted to get you on to discuss several kinds of macroeconomic issues. First of all, what's your evaluation of the state of the recession we're seeing, signs of a little uptick in the leading indicators, the weekly unemployment claims numbers improving. We've got signs of stabilization in the housing market. People spying green shoots of recovery all about us. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I'm not a big believer in the green shoots. I think if you look at, say, the job market, where we lost about 570,000 jobs a month for the 8 months between, say, September and March of this year, then we pitched a couple months in May and June where the pace of job loss declined, to only just under 400,000 a month. And I guess that feels like relief in the context of the more than half year that preceded it of losing almost 600,000. But it's a really poorly performing economy. And so I think we're going to look at, we got GDP report coming out tomorrow. And my best guess is that we'll see a contraction in the second quarter of 2009. It's going to look around 1.5% to 2%. And we're going to get a big boost actually from the stimulus package from this quarter, which is good news. But the bad news is the underlying trend in the economy, absent the stimulus, isn't all that different from the just terrible performance that we've seen for the past half year.
Let's talk about that stimulus a bit. I know you think that that's beginning to show up. A lot of people complaining that not much money moving, and what is moving too slowly. What do you see moving through the system?
Well, there's a couple things that are going to show up pretty big, I think, in the second quarter of 2009. There's a very big one-time payment to Social Security and disability recipients, and that's going to add, I think that alone is about $14 billion that's just going to drop into a single quarter, and that's not small money for that. There's also a huge amount of business tax cuts that are going to show up in the second quarter. They're not going to do much to boost the economy, I'm afraid. But there's some serious spending and some serious tax cuts. The Making Work Pay tax credit, which is kind of like a payroll tax refund, that's going to put some serious money in. And so as long as people don't just ratchet up their savings rate in a big way again, which they might do, given what's going on in the economy around that. So I think we will get some boost from the stimulus package in the second quarter. The big spending projects, like the infrastructure stuff, that's going to take longer to get online. We're not going to see a lot of that in the second quarter. That's perfectly fine because the economy is going to be weak for a long, long time. So when it comes, I think it'll be welcome. But I do think there's enough in the way of unemployment insurance, food stamps, the one-time payment to Social Security recipients. I think it's going to make a difference for the quarter.
Is it actually a stroke of luck that the stimulus money is moving as slowly as it is because it will continue to flow through next year at a time when the economy will probably need that kind of stimulus? I mean, is it going to provide longer-term support than those who are impatient for it to kick now?
I think it will. I think it's a good thing that the stimulus money will come online in a more serious manner in, say, the middle to late 2010, because that's when the unemployment rate is actually expected to peak. I mean, the bad news is you've got some parts of the stimulus package, like the expanded unemployment benefits, that are right now scheduled to run out sort of before the infrastructure payments kick in. Now, luckily, even our Congress will probably do the right thing and keep those unemployment extensions in place. But currently, they run out a lot. They run out sort of in a hard cliff, I think, September of next year, and you're going to see a big drop-off in the stimulus impact because of that.
Oh, of course, there's some people in Congress who are talking about a second stimulus program, but it seems that the consensus is against that. How do you read the politics of further spending?
I don't know. I mean, What I've heard from a lot of people is that for those of you, and I'm one of them, who would like to see sort of more stimulus from the government, you absolutely cannot call it the second stimulus package. You need to talk about extending unemployment in one package, and you need to throw things onto other bills like the highway reauthorization. And it's not obvious to me that that's an easier political pull than calling it a second stimulus package. I think there's a lot of things. I think the stimulus package as a whole is probably about as popular as the sum of its parts, for good or bad. So it's not obvious to me that not calling it a second stimulus package makes it easier to pass. But I definitely think we need more economically, and I'm willing to defer to others on the best political way to do it. But it's not clear to me that the way to do it is kind of in a more stealthy manner, rather than just being upfront and saying the economy's still weak, we need more help.
Well, what about some of the longer-term stuff? I saw Christina Romer, the president's chief economic advisor, at least by title, if not fact, a few months ago at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she was talking about a real economic transformation. She was talking about investment in green technologies really providing a kick to long-term growth because it's not going to come from consumption. Consumers are overextended and probably in a belt-tightening mode for some time to come. So it's got to come from business investment, and she sees the most promising form of business investment to be some sort of environmentally friendly technologies, leading to a real transformative growth of a longer term. Are people talking about that in Washington, or are we just such prisoners of convention that nobody's able to think in those longer-term ways?
A couple people are talking in that way, and I guess that's a great start. I mean, to me, a way to make that happen, though, is obviously, you know, you need the policy levers that make that possible, and a key one is put a price on carbon to make those investments in renewables and other energy efficiency investments really pay off. And then, to me, I think the government is also going to need to step up and not just see this as a stimulus package for 2 years, like you say, but you know, think of this as a public investment reconstruction effort that needs to take place on a much longer scale. I mean, some of the good stuff that was actually in the Waxman-Markey bill that came through the House, and it came through in the end in a pretty mangled form. But my friends who are kind of green wonks say some of the investment stuff in there is genuinely good and will do a lot both for, you know, providing lots of infrastructure investment, but also going a long way to making us a more green economy. So that's mildly encouraging, but on the whole, you know, that kind of talk is kind of few and far between and not generally backed up by the aggressive policy measures that you would need to see happen to make it actually occur in the long run.
I'm talking to Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Let's step back in history a little bit. I noticed you did a report a little while back examining the 2001 to 2007 expansion and pronounced it pretty stinky. What was so stinky about it, and why?
What was so stinky about it was just that, you know, too many people on the left, I think, sort of see anything that's above zero GDP growth is somehow a victory, and then instantly move to talking about how the fruits of that GDP growth have not been equitably distributed. And the second part is clearly right. We've got a real inequality problem in the United States in the 2000s. Just saw that continue. But, you know, it's no real magic to get positive GDP growth. I mean, a really fair comparison would be to rank that expansion that we saw between 2001 and 2007 to the others that came before it. And so we did that in a paper. We looked at, you know, the really top-line numbers, GDP growth, investment, employment growth, the unemployment rate. And by almost every measure, except for corporate profits, the 2001 to 2007 expansion was pretty much dead last. I mean, we tried to do every kind of comparison you could, peak to peak, trough to trough, you know, try to give it any chance it could to fight its way out of the bottom, and it generally did not. I mean, one of the really striking things is the employment to population ratio, you know, the share of the adult population that actually has a job. It did not budge between the previous trough, so the bottom of the recession in 2001, and the peak of 2007. And that's just unacceptable performance, I think, by anyone's standards. So, yeah, we passed the zero mark in terms of GDP growth, and somehow that means that we're supposed to applaud the expansion. But in any serious historical comparison, it was really a pretty terrible recovery.
You did point out that corporate profits did very, very well in the expansion. So it was really the most class lopsided expansion we've seen since, you know, well, since modern statistics began, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, that's definitely right. I think some of those corporate profits are probably going to be given back in years to come, as because a lot of them, you know, we know that the financial sector share of total corporate profits peaked in this expansion. I think it was 2003 or four. They actually went over 40% of total corporate profits for the financial sector. And, you know, those were pretty ephemeral, and they're just going to be given back, I think, in years to come as we write down all the bad assets that sector took on. So I don't even want to give it too much credit for that one, but it's true that, as it was, you know, as there's any portion of GDP that did well at all in historical terms, it was only corporate profits over that time.
And if we put these two things together, that weak expansion and this very deep and long recession, we have a terrible decade, economically speaking. This is really about the worst decade in American economic history. What's the problem? What is the pathology that's making things so gloomy?
I think that is the big question, and I don't think I have a very convincing answer of it. I mean, I definitely think that if we somehow, you know, reinstituted those institutions that spread out GDP growth a little more equitably, a stronger labor movement, a higher minimum wage, a stronger safety net, I think that would not only be good for distributional purposes, but I think it would make people less dependent on taking on more and more debt just to make their living standards rise, because they could actually make those living standards rise out of their own wage growth. And I think we'd have a more durable, not just a more fair economy. That said, you know, do I really think it was just the inequality that made the overall macro performance so bad? I don't even know if I can convince myself of that. I think that I must be missing something. But I do think of a part of the way to getting to even a stronger economy, not just a more fair one, is reversing that trend towards ever greater inequality.
But it's amazing to me that, you know, this fact that the decade is shaping up to be so bad, a very weak expansion followed by a very deep recession, we should be talking about that more. This should be a political issue, and it's not really.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a good chance. I mean, one of the striking things about how bad the previous expansion was, median family income never regained its 1999 peak in the 2000s expansion. It ended 2007 lower than it was in 1999. Then the recession hit, and we don't have data on what happened in 2008 yet, but if you look at how long this recession is, what usually happens in terms of family income and the unemployment rate, it is likely that we will see 15 years between any growth in median family income. It'll probably be 1999 to 2014 before we see median family income start to show gains. That's incredible. I mean, you talk about lost decades. I think it's probably going to be a lost decade and a half on that really fundamental measure of how the economy is doing, which is median family income.
All right, we've got to bring it to a close there. Thanks for joining us, Josh Bivens. I've been speaking with Josh Bivens, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about labor with Steve Early.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies. And I don't get fooled by the factory rules, because I always read between the lines. And I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, this is what I say. Oh.
And that was a bit of the Straubs doing Part of the Union from 1973, a great labor anthem that seems way out of date now when labor is flat on its back. We are now joined by Steve Early, a labor journalist who's been at this game for a couple of decades and has collected many of his writings into a book called Embedded with Organized Labor, just out from Monthly Review Press. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me on the show, Doug.
Yeah, so give us your history. You worked for the Communications Workers Union for many years, and now you've retired to the glamorous and lucrative world of radical journalism, huh?
Well, I prefer to use another R word. I like to think of myself as redeployed rather than retired, but okay. I did finish up my 27-year stint as a national organizer and rep for CWA 2 years ago. Had always done a lot of freelance journalism on the side, some of which is collected in this new book, and over the last couple of years have had the luxury of being able to write full-time.
Well, okay, whenever I look at the world of organized labor, it seems like a fairly bleak thing to me. And so encourage me, inspire me. Is there something hopeful in the U.S. labor movement that is missing my my perception?
Well, I think the the terrible economic conditions of the last 6 to 12 months have triggered at least some encouraging rank-and-file responses. One, much discussed, much publicized, but still quite relevant, was the sit-down strike by members of the United Electrical Workers last December in Chicago. A small manufacturing plant failed to give them proper notice of a shutdown. The workers, with the encouragement of their small and feisty national union, occupied the plant, really the first time there'd been a sit-down since the late 1930s, galvanized the local labor movement, attracted national attention, put a lot of pressure on the employer and its banker, Bank of America. The story actually had a happy ending. Even after the workers evacuated the plant, they were able to negotiate a new contract with a successor employer. The plant's been reopened. And I think this really is an example in miniature of the kind of shop floor militants and initiative and proactive approach that we need to see on a much larger scale in response to layoffs, plant shutdowns, and all the other wage cuts and benefit takeaways that employers are trying to impose on workers right now.
Well, that didn't just happen spontaneously, right? The union had a lot to do with it.
It did, but the largely immigrant workforce of this local, employed at Republic Window and Door, had been through a history of struggle over the last 10 years. The members have been trapped in a succession of kind of corrupt and dysfunctional independent unions before they got rid of them and voted in the United Electrical Workers. And the UE has a long history of working with limited resources to maximize the impact of membership activity, something that other much bigger unions routinely fail to do.
You write about the history of UE. It was a radical union that got crushed in the McCarthyite 50s, right?
Yes. The UE is unfortunately a shadow of its former self, down to less than 20,000 members nationwide, whereas right after the end of World War II, it was the third largest industrial union, had close to 600,000 members, but was decimated by investigations and criminal prosecutions and raiding by other unions in the 1950s. But it continues to soldier on as a very inspiring example, independent of any major labor federation, of how a member-based union can really function a lot more effectively than unions with much bigger treasuries, larger staffs, and a higher profile.
And since your book, Embedded with Organized Labor, just out from Monthly Review Press, is a collection of pieces written over the years, there's some stuff in there from the around 1995 when Sweeney and et al. Took over at the AFL-CIO. I remember a lot of enthusiasm at the time. It was when I was first doing this radio show, as I remember. This was the new breeze, the new voice that was going to transform the labor movement. 15 years later, they look like a bunch of old farts, and they all look pretty tired. What happened? What happened to all that spirit of 15 years ago?
Well, I think the New Voice Project has kind of run out of gas. I don't want to minimize the degree to which when Sweeney and his running mates were first elected and took over in the mid-1990s, they were able to, for a time, shake things up in the central bureaucracy of the labor movement. There was a new focus on supporting union organizing. There was some very positive outreach to community organizations, to groups, to students, to immigrants, a relationship with labor-oriented academics was quite fruitfully reestablished. But I think over time, some of the initiatives have bogged down. Too many of them really can't be implemented from the top down. They have to really be introduced from the bottom up with more buy-in from local unions and central labor councils and rank-and-file members. And over time, the reform project initiated by Sweeney has just run out of gas. Now, some people are putting their hopes now in his successor, his Secretary Treasurer for all these 14 years that he's been in, Rich Trumka, who expects to take over as the new president of the AFL-CIO in September.
Now, but is there something structurally wrong? I mean, is it much larger than the personnel involved? Is there something pathological about the structure of American unions?
I think there is something wrong with the structure of the AFL-CIO. I think whether headed by conservatives, which it was for many years, or more progressive folks, which it has been to a degree in recent years, the bureaucracy is just too big. It's too top-heavy. It's too much focused inside the Beltway. I think the labor movement would function better if we had a much more decentralized federation structure, if resources were spread out rather than concentrated in the headquarters operation. It's not sustainable anymore in light of the AFL-CIO split, where seven major unions left four years ago. It's created serious financial problems. Other national unions that remained are restive, and that's why there's been a move over the last 6 months to try to figure out a way that the Change to Win coalition, AFL-CIO unions, and an independent union, the National Education Association, could come together in some sort of structure that wouldn't be as top-heavy with bureaucracy, but would allow for some coordination of labor activity, particularly around legislative and political goals.
I'm speaking with Steve Early, a longtime labor journalist who has a new collection of his work over the years out called Embedded with Organized Labor, just from Monthly Review Press. Well, what about the Change to Win gang? I mean, that was launched a couple of years ago with a great high level of expectations. They're going to do more organizing. They're going to be the new guy on the block and shake free of the old ossified models. But now that's come to nothing, too. What happened to them?
Well, the unions that led the charge out the door have found that organizing the unorganized on their own isn't any easier than it was as part of the broader tent of the AFL-CIO. There's been an equivalent shrinkage of membership over the last 3 years among the Change to Win unions, and lately there's been some very disturbing organizational cannibalism in which one major union, Unite Here, the merged organization of garment workers and hotel workers, has kind of come apart at the seams. A minority faction left affiliated with the service employees, and now the new president of Unite Here, John Wilhelm from the hotel workers, is accusing Andy Stern, the head of the service employees, of wholesale aggression on his union. So within what was supposed to be a new and different labor federation, we're seeing some of the same dysfunctional behavior long exhibited by the AFL-CIO.
And of course, you read about this in your book, but you say that it used to be 11th or 12th commandment that you didn't mess with the internal affairs of other unions, but it seems like Stern et al. Were doing just that, weren't they?
Yes, and I think that it's not a commandment that I've ever observed very carefully, but the kind of meddling that's going on now, the kind of interference, is not helpful. It's a major distraction from making progress in Washington on labor law reform, healthcare reform. A lot of resources are being diverted into internecine warfare, both within the service employees itself and certainly in this dispute between SEIU and one of its founding co-founding unions of Change to Win, Unite Here. There are folks calling for a ceasefire. I don't know if one is going to be arranged, but certainly SEIU is damaging its reputation in the progressive community as more and more one-time allies are questioning why it's behaving in this fashion.
Well, you mentioned labor law reform, and there have been a great deal of hope placed in the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, the card check provisions of that. Was this worth all the hope that was invested in it, and where is it now?
Well, I think it's definitely been worthwhile for labor at the grassroots to build the infrastructure of a workers' rights campaign, which a lot more existing union members have kind of bought into and participated in than, say, 30 years ago when the AFL-CIO tried to lobby for labor law reform under Jimmy Carter and pursued a much more inside-the-beltway approach, relying on professional lobbyists and campaign contributions and so forth. A lot more rank-and-file union members understand the importance of organizing to defending what's left of their own collective bargaining and agreements. Unfortunately, the campaign seems to be foundering on the shoals of the U.S. Senate, being an institution that's both geriatric and undemocratic. There's probably still a simple majority in favor of the Employee Free Choice Act in the Senate, but the requirement of a supermajority, 60 votes to shut off a Republican filibuster, is a much higher standard, and it's one that backers of the bill clearly can't meet, given business opposition, some wavering among centrist Democrats, and kind of tepid support lately from President Obama.
Yeah, has the Obama administration really done much to promote the bill, or are they just sort of sitting back and
letting
the Senate
kill? 11 national union leaders met with him several weeks ago at the White House, kind of a low-profile meeting, no big photo ops, no big press releases, no orchestrated publicity. And there he made it clear that his top priority was health care reform. Some of the union folks pushed for moving the workers' rights agenda faster. I think when they sit there in the Roosevelt Room with the president, too many of them are too polite. John Sweeney came out and didn't even mention card check, the main and most controversial feature of the Employee Free Choice Act. So in some ways, I think the top labor officialdom in Washington needs to become more aggressive in their dealing with Senate and House Democrats and the White House if they want to see any action on workers' rights this year or even next year.
Do the unions ever think, at the top level, do they ever think about what the return is and all the money they spend in the Democratic Party? Like, it's with scores of millions of dollars every election cycle they pump into the and all the people who are working phone banks and knocking on doors, do they get anything in return for that? And do they ever wonder if they're like a battered spouse?
Yeah, I think the battered spouse analogy is a good one. I think the Democrats are perpetually a disappointment waiting to happen where labor is concerned. At the top level, certainly people experience a different difference. There's greater access. There's friendlier appointments at the Department of Labor and the National Labor Relations Board. People do get invited to meetings at the White House. They're consulted. They feel more a part of what's going on in the federal government, certainly as opposed to being excluded and being pariahs under the Republicans. However, does that produce the kind of gains that are needed for the rank and file at this point? It has not so far. I mean, the stimulus bill has not done what needs to be done in terms of job creation. Healthcare reform is turning into quite a muddle, and labor law reform seems to be slipping off the radar screen as well. Trade, which the Democrats promised to do something about last year on the presidential campaign trail, acknowledging some of the mistakes they may have in the past with NAFTA and GATT and other agreements, isn't even mentioned at all as something that they plan to address this year.
What about health care reform? Have the unions been active in that campaign, or are they just sort of delegating responsibility to Democrats
bag.
Again?
You know, the top leadership of the mainstream unions, certainly the AFL-CIO, the service employees taking the lead for the Change to Win, I think they're poised to settle short, to sign off on a reform bill that isn't going to change very much for most working people, certainly not those who are union members and already have negotiated health care plans. The single-payer movement within labor has actually been galvanized. The more that option has been excluded from the table, as they say in Washington, the more aggressive union activists supporting single-payer have been in terms of targeting particular members of the House and Senate and engaging in grassroots lobbying, working with Representative Kucinich and Senator Sanders to at least make sure that out of this process, the states will have the option to experiment further with single-payer systems at the local level.
All right, so if it were you taking over the AFL-CIO instead of the likely Rich Trumka come September, What would you do to revive this moribund labor movement?
Well, I would really invest a lot more in what you might call rank-and-file capacity building. The labor movement at its base has one great underutilized resource, and that's billions of members. And too often they're not called upon to help build power the only way that a union can build and wield it, in the workplace through the activity of workers. Too often we see an encouragement of reliance on full-time officials and staff, on lawyers, on lobbyists, on consultants, on kind of technocratic approaches to rebuilding labor strength. And I think those unions which have concentrated on developing their stewards, devoting more resources to labor education in grassroots fashion, to building member-based organizing programs and really involving their members in contract fights rather than just rolling over and accepting the latest concessions demanded by their employers, are going to emerge from this difficult period, this recession, in better shape and may be able to lead some sort of 1930s-style rebound.
Well, maybe I'm being too cynical, but suppose the leadership of the unions really don't want the members to be involved. They lead comfortable lives. They're well paid. They get to go to conferences and snazzy resorts and have an audience with the president now and then. And they don't want the trouble that an activated rank and file might cause. Is that too cynical an interpretation?
No, and that tension certainly and that kind of class divide within the labor movement was on dramatic display in the 1930s when many of the old guard leaders of the American Federation of Labor enjoyed similar privileges, were similarly detached from the day-to-day job and life experiences of billions of unorganized workers. And that's why there was, at some point in the 30s, a rank-and-file revolt, an attempt to build new unions, to break away from the old AFL, and to try to build something better from the bottom up, more responsive to the needs of working members. And I think in one form or another, that is going to happen again. I think it needs to.
So could we look forward to two, three, many Republic doors and windows?
I think they won't all take follow the same playbook, but the Republic doors and windows strikers, when they went around the country on a recent Jobs with Justice-sponsored tour, drew big crowds of rank-and-file workers. I know in Boston, where I live, and other cities, people are really hungry for models, for examples, no matter how small scale, of fighting back and winning. And I think groups like Jobs with Justice, Labor Notes, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, perform a really invaluable service of kind of networking and sharing information about these models, promoting them, and encouraging other groups of workers to try them out.
Well, and you too, Steve Early, perform a valuable service in chronicling all this, and it's all available in your new book, Embedded with Organized Labor, and that's just out from Monthly Review Press. Thanks for joining us, Steve. Good luck with the book, and thanks for your work.
Thanks for having me on again.
All right, and that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, which is a bit of Chatterbox by DJ Yoda and Sway. Bye.
You've been telling you things that doesn't really matter to you. And then they even follow you to the toilet and they're talking and talking and just won't leave you alone and it's biting your ear off. See, I've got a friend, my friend's called Tom, and I've got another friend called James, and you know James, he was talking to me about Tom. So I know that James and Tom, when they're together, they talk about me.
Yeah.
Because I talk about Tom to James, and it's all confusing, but we're all friends, we're all together, everybody's happy and everybody's nice, you know what?
Rumors, rumors, chat, chat. People like to chat, chat. Anybody, anywhere, somebody, somewhere is talking behind your back. Back. Chat, chat. Rumors, rumors. Everybody wants the newest exclusive. People get caught telling these, spreading these. They come up with numerous excuses.
I go onto the internet and type out my name on Google or Yahoo, and lots of links come up. I click on some of these things to see what some of these things are saying. A lot of different things come up. Some of these things are good, and some of these things are bad. Some of them make me happy, and some of them make me happier and glad that I'm not one of them sad chatterboxes talking, talking nonsense, nonsense while I'm eating caffeine. Yeah. Whispers, whispers, Richard, Julie, Richard, EastEnders, gonna wash out of our mouth, mowing out the moon.